My name is Steve Miller, host of the podcast Book Artists and Poets. It's July 15th, 2009, and I'm sitting here with Carol Barton, the great pop-up queen, at Wells Book Arts Summer Institute. Carol, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
I'm sorry I threw that one in there at you, but I always think of you as the pop-up queen.
Well, I have been referred to as that before. Princess, maybe.
Pop-up princess?
Yeah.
And Carol and I are both actually teaching at the Wells Book Arts Summer Institute. We're sitting here in Morgan Hall, and it's 9:30 at night. It's been a long, long day of teaching, and your class is called Paper Engineering and Sculptural Books. And
right.
What the heck are you trying to do with these people here?
Oh, they are learning how to make pop-ups. They're having a great time, and they really have learned already. We've been here 3 days, a whole lexicon of pop-up structures that they can use to start building their own ideas. Of course, the challenge is getting then the visual concept melded with the engineered structure.
So do you teach them, of course, I guess from structure to structure, but are you also talking about content at the same time?
We're looking at a lot of commercial books and some artist books that have incorporated pop-ups into them. And we're looking how artists and commercial artists and fine artists have blended their visual image with the pop-up. Now, in the commercial world, a lot of times the paper engineer and the illustrator are two different people, and they can really go head-to-head because the visual artist is thinking one way and the paper engineer is thinking structurally. The visual artist is thinking in terms of images. And I can guarantee you that the paper engineer always wins that fight.
Let's step back for a second for people out there who might not know what pop-ups are all about, how they're manifested in books. Could you just give a short description of that?
Sure. Well, I see pop-ups as sculpture within books. So they are somewhat akin to origami because they are built out of paper and they are very sculptural. The difference is that they're mechanical. They have to move. The page acts like a lever in a machine. So as the page is opened and closed, just like a lever, the pop-up is lifting. It's actually lifting to close and then dropping into three dimensions as the page is opened. That's the part that really fascinates me, is that mechanical aspect of it, not just the fact that it, you know, turns into a three-dimensional thing, but that it moves and that the book, you know, flattens out into a perfectly, you know, flattened object, and then it becomes this three-dimensional sculptural piece when you open the book up.
What kind of people are in your class? What are their interests that bring them?
I have a really broad range of people in the class. I've got a rabbi who does paper cutting and was interested in pushing that skill into the paper engineering. I have a 14-year-old who is really amazing. I mean, she just got right into it and is doing incredible pop-ups and very good at the cutting aspect. I have a student from Syracuse who's has an art background, and so she's pushing that into the books with the sculptural elements of the pop-ups, and a librarian. I've had doctors, nurses. I've had graphic designers in other classes. Then a lot of people who just want to have fun. You know, it's a fun thing to learn. You can pick up the basic, very simple cut and fold pop-ups within half a day, pretty easily. So you don't even need any glue for those.
How cool. I ought to set up the scene a little bit. We're in a conference room. We've kind of closed it off here. This building is all about book arts. The ground floor is a couple of beautiful letterpress studios where work is ongoing right now as we speak. Further down the hallway is the studio where you're working in, and it is completely packed with people tonight. right in front of that studio, Michael Durgan is playing what?
Steel drums. We've got a steel drum concert going on.
Set up in the hallway here. So if in the background you hear some noises, that's kind of the action that's going on. And then way upstairs,
lettering workshop, calligraphy is
Nancy
being taught.
Nancy Kulmoni is teaching the beautiful lettering workshop. The Summer Institute is really wonderful.
Great mix.
Nancy Heal, who does this thing, ought to be given so many awards for bringing all these great people together. And then down the hill, Wells is this beautiful, pristine kind of very small town, traditional with great wide swales of grass kind of place, and a Harry Potter dining room.
Isn't that one great?
It's astonishing.
Are you waiting for the brooms to come out of the ceiling there?
And down this grassy hill here, it ends in a very, very beautiful lake, and later on tonight there's going to be a big bonfire, I hear. Mm-hmm. Carol, how long have you been doing this, and how in the heck does somebody become suddenly motivated to learn about this kind of work and do it?
I've been working in book arts and paper engineering for about 25 years. My schooling was in painting. I went to Washington University in St. Louis. And when I moved to Washington, D.C., I took a job at Wolf Trapp Performing Arts Center and then landed in another incredible job. It was an arts administration job at a little arts center in an old amusement park called Glen Echo Park. Hmm. It was Washington's old amusement park up until 1964, and then it evolved into an arts center. So I was on the administrative staff there. One of the artist groups was called the Writer Center. I mean, mainly there were writing classes taught, but they had a little offset press, a little multi-lift press. It didn't even stay in register, one color press. And a bunch of people from Visual Studies Workshop had come down and were running this press. Kevin Osborne was there, Sue Ann Robinson was there, Alec Dan, a bunch of people that the artist book world would recognize very quickly. Brad Freeman was there later on. I wasn't too interested in the press at the beginning, but I did have a photography background from school also, and learned how to use the stat camera, learned how to use the typesetter there. They had all of the pre-press equipment there, and I became pretty familiar with that because I was producing brochures within my job. Then a few years later, they received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to produce 20 artist books. And the director just came up to me one day and said, "We just got this grant. We need 20 artists to do a book. Can we give you some money and you could try doing a book?" And I said, "Sure." So, you know, it was the easiest grant I ever got. I didn't even apply for it. It came to me. I spent a year doing the first book. It was called Beyond the Page, and it didn't have any pop-ups in it, but it did have die-cut windows and doors and openings in every page. So you would look into the environment, into the next page, and look back into the previous page. And that book was die-cut by Thrifty Paper Box Company in downtown Washington, so I went down to see the die-cutting process.
Was that fun?
Oh, it was really fun. And this box company was totally blown away by this job. I mean, they made cardboard boxes, and here's this book with these weird window openings and doors in it that they were cutting. So they were excited by that. It was a different sort of job. The process was so difficult, I said I'd never, ever do another book. And then it started to sell. Well, that was a pleasant change. And a friend of mine found a carousel book, a used carousel book in Italian, probably dating from the early 1900s, at a book sale. And it's a carousel book is a multi-layered accordion book. Each page is about three or four layers deeper and deeper going back into the book. There are cutouts in the pages. So it's almost like a stage set with layers of scenery. And it creates.
And you can go all the way around.
You can go
it
all the way around
into it.
It pulls into a circle, which is where the name carousel comes from. They're also called star books because if you look down from the top, the multiple layers of accordions look like a star. They are very theatrical, so you're looking into these pages. They're like little theater scenes, and it tells the story by going around the carousel. the whole thing closes flat and it opens into this incredible theatrical circle. And I was amazed by that. After seeing that carousel book, I realized that there might be other types of historic books that had sculptural formats mm-hmm. or had dimensional elements to them. And I contacted the rare book librarian at the Dibner Library, which is part of the Smithsonian Library System. Her name was Ellen Wells, and made an appointment to come down to the library. She was a fantastic librarian because she knew where every book in that collection was that had any sort of sculptural element or moving part in it.
You have to love the librarians.
The librarians know what they're doing. They know when even the card catalog doesn't tell you where the things are. They have it in their heads.
And they respect your passion.
Mm-hmm. And so she pulled every book out of the collection that had any sort of sculptural element in it. And I was able to go down over successive weeks and look through them and eventually photograph them. And she also had a lot of catalogs from book shows that had had these rare books with sculptural elements in them. And the rare books, the early books from the 1400s, 1500s, usually are not cataloged as having these extra rotating wheels and lift-up flaps or anything in them. So you really have to sort of know where they are to find them. So she did know where they are, and she knew how to access the information on where books in other collections were. So I started scouring all the great libraries in Washington. Hmm. There's the Library of Congress, there's the National Library of Medicine. A lot of embassies have libraries, and the Smithsonian has an extensive set of libraries within all of the museums. So I was able to really pull a lot of material out of that research.
So clearly you are really excited deeply mm-hmm. about this sculptural aspect of the book.
Right. And I think that comes from the fact that my father was a diesel engine mechanic. We had a shop in the basement. I grew up building things and taking things apart. You know, there was the mechanics of it, and he was always showing me mechanical things. So that mentality really translated into the pop-ups, the dimensional aspect of the books and how they moved and opened and closed and the sculptural elements there.
You started making these kind of books. And mm-hmm. have you seen in the course of your time in making books, has your interest changed? Has the content changed? How has it evolved for you?
The initial books were simpler. I had the ability to usually look at a historic book and sort of figure out how it was put together because there weren't any manuals or classes on this at that time. And a lot of the people in the field either came from a 3D background or an engineering background, an architectural background. They just sort of had a natural ability to build these things. And I had grown up with that bit of ability to look at things and figure out how they were constructed. The subject matter has changed. I base a lot of my books on research and just subjects I love. And I love being in Washington because you do have access to all of these incredible resources, not just the libraries, but the museums. The patent office is one of my favorite wacky places in Washington because it's full of the strangest 200 years of ideas that we have. So I scour the patent office for unusual things. I mean, I
You're
love
one of the
science.
Usual suspects
yes.
at the patent office.
Well, I'm not one of those patent lawyers. They get pretty, they're an odd bunch down there. But a lot of times I just go in without even knowing what I'm looking for and start pulling sheaves of patents off the shelves and seeing what I find. My favorite level is the mezzanine. That's where all the design patents are. So anything that's designed, I mean, coat hangers, game boards, clock faces, televisions, even lead type was at that point because it was an object patented. It wasn't copywritten because it was an object that actually, there are lead type patents in the patent office. And so if you go up there, you know, you can pull a whole sheaf of patents off the shelf and find 500 designs for forks or 300 designs of bicycles. So it's really an amazing place. It's one of those sort of secret places that not a lot of tourists know about, mm-hmm. but it's one of my favorite places in Washington. Mm-hmm. It's almost like walking into a Kafka novel, because it's one of the strangest government agencies I know.
Your work has escalated in complexity over mm-hmm. time.
Mm-hmm. One of the last books I did incorporated lights into it. So I spent a lot of time figuring out just switching and wiring, how to switch the book on and off just with the opening and closing of the book. And I ended up using a reed switch, which is a magnetic switch for that. Magnets embedded in one side of the book. And when the magnet hits the switch, it turns the light off. And when the book is opened, it turns the light on.
Can you, you showed this book
yes.
last night, and it is absolutely remarkable. Can you talk about this book for all, kind of walk us through it a little bit? It
sure.
is astonishing.
I'd had the idea of a book with a light in it for a long time. And originally I'd started designing a tunnel book with a light at the end and just never followed through on that idea. I had a chance to apply for a residency in Italy, and this was the idea that really I thought would work over there. The book involves 5 luminous towers, and I was looking at a lot of different types of towers within the history of Italy. They're not specific towers in Italy, but they relate to different functions of the tower within Italian history. We've got a lookout, a bell tower, church tower, a fortress, a lighthouse, and then the last tower, I call it the vanity tower, but in a town like San Gimignano, when everyone was trying to build a higher tower than their neighbor as a status symbol, and that last tower has the added element of fiber optic filaments that come out the top, and in a completely darkened room, it forms a little halo of stars around the tower. The poems were poems I wrote when I was over there relating to those different buildings, and the text floats on translucent panels above the light also. So in a completely darkened room, you can read the entire text and then see the lighthouses and the various towers between the text as you're turning the pages.
Oh, man.
So it was, a challenge on many levels. It was the getting the electricity to working with the lights. I ended up using Dan Kelm's wire binding because another challenge was the pop-ups add quite a bit of thickness to the pages, and I had to make sure that the towers all work with a single light at the back of the book, so they have to be floating right above the light when that page is opened, and the text block shifts slightly from left to right as you're turning the pages. So the text block is actually on a tab that can slide back and forth as the pages are turned. There was that mechanical difficulty of the text block. There was getting the pages to open completely flat. Dan Kelm's wire binding allowed for expanding the pages just a little by using thicker wires, and so that allowed for a distance between the pages that would accommodate the thickness of the tower pop-ups between them. And then it was getting it all into a case, just having it all work together. It was a real challenge. It took about a year and a half to get the final edition printed and assembled.
What's the name of the book?
5 Luminous Towers, a book to be read in the dark.
What a wonderful name. I love that. Well, the thing is something special to look at. How many copies did you make?
I printed 50. It was printed at the University of the Arts Borowski Center. And I've assembled 30. I have 20 yet to assemble. I usually assemble about 10 or 15 at a time, and it takes several weeks to put them all together. And I make the boxes, the cases, too.
Did you do the printing, or did you work with a printer?
I worked with Lori Spencer at the Borowski Center, and she's just a dream printer.
You know, I love what is happening at the University of the Arts. You know,
the
people there are
Center.
Just swell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the few places, I mean, Columbia and the Borowski Center, mm-hmm. that still have an offset press going that's running for
right.
artists to use as a tool.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There used to be many more of them, but unfortunately we've lost some of them.
when you finish the book, how did the books get out into the world?
That edition was quite small and the most expensive one I've done. I do a mailing to the museums and library collections that I know have collections of artist books. Normally with the editions I do pretty large editions for artist books. 500, 600 was the largest.
Seriously?
Yes, 600 of the book Loom, and I put them all together myself. I don't hire anybody. I really enjoy that batch work, the production work, where you're doing all of the sewing at one point, and then you're putting all of the pieces together, and then finally the whole book starts coming together.
Isn't that interesting? Because some people that you talk to say, oh, I could never make more than five copies of something.
Oh, and just seeing those 500 copies stacking up in front of you is so satisfying. So I love that work. It is so peaceful. I think we've lost a lot of that in our society. I mean, there used to be all the chores that you had to do repetitively, and it was very calming and therapeutic. And now we're rushing around like crazy half the time. So that peaceful time where you're just doing handwork and your mind is allowed to wander, I think is very precious. And I think we should sort of adapt more of that into our lives.
When you're doing this work, do you listen to music?
Often I listen to music, and sometimes I'm working in a quiet studio and thinking about the next book or just other ideas, but a lot of times I am listening to music. That's very soothing.
So, Carol, these towers that you just did, these five towers, how does it get from looking at a tower or whatever, drawings of tower, how does it get to the point where you can actually put it inside? What's the process?
Most paper engineers, and this includes me, do not use math. Do not do a lot of formulas or not working on the computer with any sort of CAD program. It's making model after model after model and refining each model just a bit until you get exactly the effect that you want. And when I'm doing an addition, I'm making not just models of the pop-ups, and that involves a lot of model making, but I'll do separate models, just testing the materials, the papers I'm using, the board, the covering material. I'll do blank books just to make sure all of that's coming together. I have other models where I'm testing out the sequencing of the images, and other models where I'm doing the writing and positioning on the page. And
that
so
part you do by computer, probably.
Usually by computer, because I'm working in offset.
Mm-hmm.
So I have piles of models, each dealing with different aspects of the book. It's very hard to hold all of that in your head at once, so you separate them out and you're doing the different chores within different models. And then as the book starts to be refined and those models are perfected, then you start combining the text with the imagery, with the pop-ups, and the whole thing starts coming together. But at first it's broken down into lots of separate parts.
Do you see your books as a narrative?
Definitely as a narrative. Some of them do not have a lot of text, but there's a visual narrative working across them. And even the tunnel books, they're also called peep show books. They're two accordions holding pages between them. And traditionally, they had openings cut out all the way through the pages. And so you're sort of looking down into a hole through this tunnel, and a scene is built up through the layers of the tunnel. So they were called peep show books too, because they were sort of like looking into a peephole and seeing a scene on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Now for me, the historic ones are not really books, because part of my definition of a book is an idea that changes across the time expanse held within the book. There is some sort of narrative, be it visual or within the text. There's some sort of change that happens in the viewer's mind as he's reading through the book. I mean, that's what the concept of reading is. It's not just a one-shot view of something, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this change that happens. And within the historic tunnel books, you just look in the hole and you see a scene and that was it. So for me, that is not really a book. What interested me was the fact that it was two accordions with pages held between them and the front and back cover. And if you start using the accordions as books in themselves, you essentially have three books right there, two accordions, the view through the middle, the front and back. And if you cover all of that surface with imagery and content, you start to force the viewer to look not just through the middle, but to look at all sides of the book from many different directions. And so then it pushes that format back into being a book because it has to be read in sequence and over the course of time of exploring all the facades of the book.
So where do your ideas for upcoming projects come from? What's intriguing to you?
They come from many different sources. Sometimes I start with a format that I find interesting. Mm. An idea evolves that fits that format. At other points, I find a bit of text that intrigues me. A lot of times it comes out of research that I'm doing when I'm going through one of the libraries or the reference museums within Washington, and I find something that just attracts me. With the loom book, which incorporates Oriental rug patterns, I just love the Oriental rug patterns, and so it was something I wanted to explore, and I knew that the rugs often represented the universe or a wider landscape than you see in the rug. A lot of times the rug has a side that sort of goes off the edge that represents more of a universe than the rug contains. And so from that idea, I got the concept of incorporating landscape images in with the rugs. So every page has a rug image. The accordion strips that are holding those pages together are two landscapes, one of the Potomac River below our house, the other of our family farm. And then when you look through the tunnel, you see the Earth, a picture of the Earth looming in outer space. It's actually a NASA photograph. You've got the loom of the rugs, the making of the rugs, the idea of the wordplay, the Earth looming in the sky. And that whole book sort of came together when I discovered the quote on the back, which is, "No one yet hath unraveled a knot from the skein of the universe, and each who came and essayed the same but made the tangle worse." When I found the quote, everything that I'd been thinking about just sort of pulled together, and I was able to be on press the next week with Brad Freeman printing that at Pyramid Atlantic.
Can you say that quote again?
Yes. "No one yet hath unraveled a knot from the skein of the universe, and each who came and essayed the same but made the tangle worse."
Oh. Would you say that your books are autobiographical in any sense?
I think everybody's books pull something from their lives, but I guess in the sense that I love research and I love science, a lot of them deal with those topics. But I don't think they're autobiographical in the way that a lot of people think that an autobiography would relate to people.
But it sounds like embedded in those projects are really significant parts of you.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Mm-hmm. It's my interest in, my love of just finding odd things out in the world and pulling disparate things together and playing with things, making them sort of fit together. All of those elements are in there. The love of science. One of my favorite radio programs is Radiolab. I think listening to that program where they're discussing the nexus of science concepts, philosophy, history, pulling all of those aspects together. I love things that do that, and I'm hoping that my books do that too.
Books, you've found, are the gathering spot for all of your various interests.
And I think that's one of the reasons that so many people are attracted to them. They really are a meeting place. Not just a meeting place for different people to come together, though historically that's been the case within books. You know, often the early books involved a whole team of people that were working to create one piece, and still there are a lot of artists that are working that way. I usually work individually, but it's a way for pulling a lot of my very disparate interests into one object, one format. So different interests in media, photography, sculpture, graphic design, typography, all of those varied interests can be pulled together into this one object, and also a lot of different interests in a wide range of topics, personal and out there in the world. So all that can come together. I think that's one of the most challenging and attractive parts of artist books.
Can I just ask you about materials? When you're talking about paper, is it better for your purposes that these papers be highly machined, or do you ever work with handmade papers, things that are rougher in character?
I do work with handmade papers on occasion, though, because a lot of my imagery is done with offset printing. More often I'm working with commercial papers. Though when I'm teaching the classes, I do want to make sure the students understand that really practically any paper can work with the pop-up. A lot of it depends on scale. If you're working very small, even a tissue paper or a rice paper can accommodate a pop-up. Mm-hmm. And then some of my students have started working huge. I mean, they've done pop-ups that are like 6 feet high, and then they have to start going to Home Depot for materials. You know, you're not working with paper anymore. You're working with board and even masonite and leather hinges and things like that.
And hard hats.
Right, hard hats too. I had one piece that actually fell over, so a hard hat would have been nice. But yeah, the scale is really determines a lot of the materials that can be used. But even furniture, folding furniture is a form of pop-up. And I've always thought that it would be great to do a theater piece or a dance piece where the dancers came out with their own props and opened them and they became the sets. Yeah. So if anybody out there knows anyone that I could collaborate with in the theater, I think that would just be a spectacular performance.
You were talking about a project that you did on birth control pills.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How
sure.
That happened?
I get a lot of interest in people wanting commercial work, and I usually turn that down and feed it to other people that I know do commercial work. But one of my friends is the director of publications for the American College of OBGYNs, mm-hmm. obstetricians and gynecologists, which is located in Washington, D.C. And that's a very staid college of physicians. But we were laughing one night. She was saying that none of the teenagers read their birth control brochures because they were so boring. And we said, we should come up with a pop-up birth control brochure because then the kids would pay attention to it. And so I went home and made a little mock-up of what we thought might work and sent it down to her. And every year during the funding cycle, she'd pull it out and they'd say, no, we can't do this. Finally, she convinced them. It was about 5 years later, and she called me up and she said, we're doing this brochure. Can you perfect the engineering on it? So we had a whole team. We had designers, and we had a art director and a writer that was doing the text, and we had an illustrator. We'd had several meetings, and we came up with this great birth control brochure. It was called Inside Facts. And one side shows all of the contraception methods, and the other side shows very graphically male and female anatomy. It's won a number of awards, and it's still in print. You can get packs of 10 of them through the American College of OBGYNs and distribute them to your friends. And I think, you know, a lot of, definitely the teenagers are not ignoring this brochure anymore.
And when you went to the press checks for it.
Yes, I went to the press checks in Baltimore, and it was quite funny. The pressman would not look me in the eye. I mean, Baltimore is still pretty traditional and Catholic, so there was some... Oh, and also... The pressmen's wives did the handwork to assemble it, and they sent home a warning letter that if they didn't want this particular job coming into the home, they could reject it.
Well, Carol, I wish you the best of luck on the last couple of days of your class here at the Wells Book Arts Summer Institute. You have people who probably ask you how to get going in this kind of work. What do you tell them?
Taking a class is a good start. Looking at a lot of the commercial books out there to see how the professional paper engineers have integrated and utilized the pop-up forms and integrated them with the imagery. And I do have two books out on how to make pop-ups that are interactive, so you can actually go through the books, cut and fold, follow the directions, and assemble the pop-ups right into the book. And I'm working on the third of that series, which is the last of the series.
What are those books called?
They're called The Pocket Paper Engineer and How to Make Pop-ups Step by Step.
Available?
In most bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon, your independent bookstores, we hope. And through my website, which is
www.popularkinetics.com. Popularkinetics.com.
Yes, it's my press.
Carol Barton, this has been really terrific. I love listening to you talk about your passion toward your work.
Thank you.
And also your generosity in sharing it with students and the world.
Oh, it's been so much fun. Thank you, Steve.